Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's neuroscience research podcast. Today is October 26, 2023. We're talking with Ben Clark, who's associate professor at the Department of Psychology at the University of New Mexico. Ben works on brain mechanisms of spatial navigation and learning, and for those in the know, this largely means the cells whose firing conveys information about an animal's location or the direction of movement. And the usual suspects are grid cells, place cells, head direction cells, edge cells, and the like. And they're located in regions like hippocampus and the cerebral cortex and the thalamus, all places that are known to be important in animal spatial navigation and learning. And Ben has studied all of the above-mentioned cell types, I think, and the ways that they come together to construct a spatial map of the environment, and the way that they can be disrupted, as in fetal alcohol exposure. So thanks for joining us, Ben.
Hello. Thank you.
Also with us is Francesco Savelli, our own spatial brain mechanisms expert and frequent podcast participant. Hi, Francesco.
Hi.
And me, I'm your host, Charlie Wilson. So, Ben, the spatial cellular responses and the network they form in the cortex and thalamus and hippocampus, sometimes referred to as the mechanism of the cognitive map in the brain. And I wonder just how literally to take that phrase, cognitive map. You know, to me, if I'm using a map, I don't just tell from it where I am and what direction I'm pointing, but I could also imagine a faraway place, even a place I've never been. But let's just imagine places we have. And then how I would get from there to some other spot without actually having to go there. Is the cognitive map that we're thinking about, I mean, that was implicit in Tolman's latent learning idea. So, or maybe even explicit. You can correct me on which it is. And so is this spatial map we're talking about in the hippocampus and in the rhino cortex that kind of a map that's really a map of the world? Or is it really more about me, where I am now, where I'm going next?
I think it provides information about where you are in the environment. I wouldn't say it's a literal map of the spatial layout. It just provides some basic information about location, maybe some goals in the environment, or other behavioral relevant areas that are kind of within the explored space or the explored environment. Sorry, can you hear me there?
That's fine. Okay. So it's really not a cognitive map. I mean, it's a map, maybe a map. I don't know, what do you think, Francesco? I mean, I've heard you say cognitive map.
I think people use the that connotation in different ways. I'm not really sure that everybody, when they think about cognitive map, they mean cognitive in the same way.
I'm sure that's so, they don't.
Yeah, so Tolman, if you go back to Tolman, you know, that paper was about cognitive maps, so that paper was really a job at the behaviorist school that wanted to understand everything through stimulus association. And so by providing that example, animals being able to get a shortcut, you know, he said, you know, like the nervous system doesn't work as a switch box, it works more like as a situation room. And so the situation room is this comprehensive map. So that's what I think, you know, he meant by cognitive.
But latent learning is another thing. Basically, he put the animals in a maze with no reinforcement anywhere.
Right.
Explore it.
Right. So the lack of reward, and the idea of this lack of reward, and it's just one of the point of, you know, just you learn something because you're geared, you know, evolution geared to learn your surroundings. And that's also something that, for example, Galley still, you know, in the organization of learning, that famous book, you know, really unpacked a lot along other directions. But then there is the idea of cognitive, because space is some kind of construct of the brain, because we don't have a sensor for space. I mean, some species have, you know, Ben has studied head direction cells. So some species, you can make the case, they have this inner compass based on some kind of magnetoreceptors. But other than that, not even all species. And then for position, you really don't have a GPS sensor. So now, you know, space is cognitive in that sense. And then there is the other thing, the O'Keefe, the idea that, okay, this map is just a scaffolding, a spatial, what they call it, an objective spatial framework on which you can, the organism can annotate all the items of events of experience, so your history. So it's just a map, and then you annotate things that have happened or other things that are cognitive in the sense that they relate to your life and you integrate your experience. So I think, I don't know, maybe, and I'm not even sure I'm exhausting all the possible ways that you can call that map cognitive, but I think people, you know, probably sometimes think multiple things when they...
I mean, if we were relating to our own experience, mm-hmm. and you say cognitive map, you might ask me, draw a diagram of your home, even though you're sitting at work, mm-hmm. and then draw yourself going from your bedroom to your mm-hmm. kitchen, mm-hmm. and we can do that. So these are places we've been, mm-hmm. and so just like in real maps, we've explored those places and we have a mm-hmm. spatial image of them, and we can construct a path to go from one to the other, and yeah. even without moving. Is this the same mechanism in the brain that we use for spatial map, or that we study in rats and in the hippocampus, or is this something completely different?
So related to the latent learning idea, so Tolman, and actually it was O'Keefe and Adel that really proposed that through exploration, an animal would acquire this sort of map-like representation. So through curiosity, exploring the extent of the environment, this representation would be constructed. And then, so my understanding is that the idea is that you learn spatial relationships between relevant stimuli and the environment, so their relative position to each other, and then you could use that information to guide your behavior to particular locations. So instead of perhaps thinking about, okay, is it a cognitive representation of a map, you might reframe the question of how are animals actually navigating to particular locations in the environment? How are they actually, how are they getting from one place to another?
So that's the thing that seems the most clearly what the data are about. So if I read that literature, I rarely find something about an imagined trajectory from one place to the other. Instead, what we get is, I place this animal in this location and it knows to go in some other place, or it knows where I put it after it's been moved around. So that's really more like a navigation, more like dead problem, reckoning yeah. than yeah. Like a GPS. Like if you really had a GPS by itself is useless to me. I used to have one. You used to be able to buy a GPS and it would tell you your latitude and longitude.
Right.
It's yeah. completely useless. Unless you had an actual map and you could find that latitude and longitude on the map. So you could think, here's one device, the GPS, and here's another thing, the map. And they only work when you put them together. So for spatial navigation in, let's say, well-known thing, like rat finding its way around, is there a metaphor that we could use like that? I hear that GPS metaphor all the time. It referred to the hippocampus. Is that just bogus?
Yeah.
I support you in that. So if you don't like GPS, go for it, because it's like, oh, I'm going to back you up.
Yeah, I think the GPS implies that there's a kind of a world-centered position. It's, but it's much more relative. And also, you know, when you think about hippocampal place cells, the place cells are locked to the stimuli within that context. So if you move some of the stimuli, it can cause some changes in the hippocampal place fields. So it's more relative to the cues that are within the environment.
Okay, good. So I'm happy with that.
Yeah. Whenever you know, at some point when obviously the topic became very, very famous, especially with the Nobel Prize won by the discoverer of glial cells and place, John O'Keefe and Edward and maybe Moser, you know, you could see everywhere these, you know, this is the GPS system of the brain. And, you know, I can see the value in just quickly communicating the idea, because it has its own value, you know, for most people, you know, you get, okay, yeah, there is a GPS sometimes constructed, but,
yeah,
you know, to the specialist, it's a problem because, you know, the GPS is really, you know, on large scale space should work metrically, it's accurate. I don't, you know, it's pretty clear we don't have anything like that in the brain. So it works a little bit like a GPS. When you think about grid cells or place cells, or it works a little bit like a GPS, but, you know, probably more contained environments, okay? And so the question now remains is how do you navigate more complex environments? And now here, I don't want to do a detour here, but, you know, I think I really need to do justice to... So I had the luck to work with Benjamin Kuipers, who is more known in the AI and cognitive science. So around when when O'Keefe and Nadella wrote their book with the hippocampus as a cognitive map, he also wrote his PhD thesis, you know, with Marvin Minsky at MIT, and, you know, he talked about cognitive maps. And his concept of cognitive maps is way more similar to what you were mentioning. So he was asking in the traditional cognitive science that was just starting, you know, in a way, it's like, what kind of knowledge, what kind of spatial knowledge is in human brains, you know, humans use to navigate? And one of, you know, of the, I'm oversimplifying here, but essentially one of the main point was that this knowledge is mostly topological, not accurate metrically, definitely not on large distances. And over time, he developed this notion about large-scale space and small-scale space, that it's about your perceptual horizon. So a football field is small-scale space because it all fits in your... I mean, you might have to turn around, but that's it. But, you know, like this office, you know, this floor, it's large-scale space. It's larger than a football field, because even if it fits into football fields, now it has all different alleys and stuff. And it's known that people, even that I might have worked in a, say, in an hospital for 30 years, then they ask them to draw a map. The map has serious errors metrically, and sometimes they put something on the right or on the left and it's on the other side. So obviously we don't easily build a metrically accurate map. But and so now the question is, where is the lot of spatial knowledge? And we talked about that when Dagnitz was here, because that thing. But the question, so but in a small environment, like, you know, maybe a room or this, you know, you can say that, you know, grid cells, you know, these spatial cells somehow work in a you know, relatively metrically accurate to some extent. And importantly, in this allocentric reference frame, which is the other character of, you know, something cognitive, because everything that is sensory for us is egocentric. But now this representation is using an allocentric. So that somehow the brain has to make non-trivial computations in order to do that.
So maybe be good at this point to just sort of review what a grid cell and a place cell is and the relationship to each other.
Yeah,
so we could start. Well, place cell are, you know, hippocampal cells that fire typically in smaller environments, at least they fire in specific locations. I mean, in larger environments, Andre Fenton has shown and others shown that their firing fields can be, there can be more than one firing field, but it's not a range. The firing fields don't have a fixed structure like you would see with a grid cell, which are cells that fire in specific repeating patterns in an environment. But the distance between the firing fields are fixed and their orientation relative to each other are fixed, such that they form equilateral triangles.
So I think one piece of this that can be confusing, especially when we use the word allocentric, is that these cells don't fire except when M goes into that spot. So it's not storing a permanent image of that spot. It's only firing when the animal goes there. So it's really still about that animal. It's just that the coordinate system is not relative to the animal.
Yes,
but
that's exactly.
If another rat walks into that spot, the that place cell isn't going to fire. Are there mirror place cells where the rat sees another rat stand over there, and so it has a place cell that fires when that other rat is standing there? Because that would really be more like a permanent map of space, not just a map of where I am.
Well, so you, well, I'm sure you understand correctly.
It's still all about
saying.
Me. You call it allocentric, but it's still all about me. The neuron doesn't fire because there is a place in the room. The neuron only fires when I'm in that place in the room.
Yes.
And so it's not a map of the room. It's still about me. It's still a map of where I am.
Yes.
There's an implicit in that is somehow there must have been a map of the room. Because otherwise, when that animal walked in there, that cell couldn't be fired there. Right? So there must be, all we see is some neuron firing when the animal goes to a particular place in this space.
Right.
That's
but,
all we see.
But, it's
but there must be more to it than that. There must be something we can't see, which is the actual memory of location.
Yeah, so
it would be more like that.
So the firing location is sort of fixed with respect to the local, you know, the geometry and the shape of the local environment, right? It has a fixed...
Which you know about as an experimenter, but you don't have any image of how the brain has stored that, right?
Well, so this is... So probably the simpler way to think about it is like whatever the animal is, there is a you are here neural pointer. And all these you are here neural pointers, some other consistent regarding with an external coordinate frame that is allocentric. And especially with grid cells, it can be pretty consistent.
Uh-huh.
And but it might be arbitrary. So like, you know, this is something you and I study. So the where is the origin of that coordinate system?
Uh-huh.
You know, it probably changed from animal to animal, but also it's arbitrary when the animal enters a new environment. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing that can set the origin of that coordinate frame. So if you add that all together, it amounts, it's revealing of a map.
Because it's revealing a map that is latent otherwise. Latent. We can't see it. Maybe there are neurons somewhere that actually represent absolute space. We don't know that because we only see the neurons that respond when the animal...
When they're locomoting through the field.
Well, I would say that green cells are probably the phenomenon that is more revealing of a representation of absolute space. Because they keep those metrical relationships. So they're universally active, so-called universally active, meaning they're always active in every environment. Actually, in that sense, it's more similar to red direction cells. And then,
but, I mean, the cell is not always active. The cell is only active when the animal is in a particular spot.
Yeah, that cell, but another cell is going to be active.
Yeah.
So all together, you know, like they're constantly tracking the animal. So... And the geometrical relationships from cell to cell, they do not vary. They seem rigid. So it's really a system that, to understand that system, you can only understand that to a point if you think about one cell. You got to understand what they're doing together. Yeah. All these cells are highly coordinated. So obviously, they not only reveal a map, they reveal a network structure of some sort, functional relationships that are embedded in that area of the brain, or somehow they are inherited, you know, from upstream. But so that's, you know.
So tell us about the world that the grid cells are representing. So grid cells are laid out on some kind of irregular spacing in space, and a grid cell will fire whenever a neuron, whether an animal is in one of the many locations in the room. And then those locations are relative to the boundaries of the room.
Yeah.
Is that right? And so there are so many by so many locations, or is it a continuum and every grid cells look kind of like they represent discrete places, but there's another grid cell that is delta X, delta Y from that one and another one?
That's what it looks like, yes. Delta X, delta Y. So it's kind of like
a
continuous. Now, how continuous that is, obviously, it's going to always hit some kind of limit, because if you think about neurons, obviously, they're discrete in the brain. But
it seems like as the room gets bigger and bigger, the spacing has to be altered, unless you can add more grid cells to the edges.
No, because they repeat. Because the pattern repeats, so essentially it keeps going. Yeah, it can go forever, technically. Yeah.
So just how many repetitions you have is what's determined by the size of the room.
Yeah, you can have...
So the spatial resolution of the grid system is fixed.
So they're divided by modules, right? So there are grids at different scales. And what has been found is that not only is topographically organized, but unlike other sensory systems, it's not continuously organized. So the scale of the grid and the orientation of the grid is discrete. But within one module that has the same scale and the same orientation, all the grids of that module, there is many of them, and it cannot cover all the space because they have kind of it's quasi-continuum phase from what we know. And so they're always rigid with each other. They maintain rigid relationships. Now, when you go from one module to another, to what extent they maintain the same relationship, it's still actively investigated.
When you go from one module to the other, they're not spatially distinct, right? You can't walk from one module into a different module, can you? Or maybe I'm not understanding what.
They all coexist.
Yeah.
They're all coactive at the same time.
You go from one to the other?
You don't. I wasn't speaking in terms of like actual space. That was like just when we consider different modules, grid cells from different modules, to what extent they maintain a geometrical relationship everywhere and kind of keeping the same geometrical relationship, for example, orientation or difference in phase, although it becomes more difficult to talk about difference in phase because obviously now one has a frequency, another has a different frequency, but you can still look
at it. So the thing that makes modules different is the spacing of the grid.
The spacing and to some extent the orientation, and possibly now they could come unlocked from each other in terms of geometrical relationship, but to what extent and what elicits there is still actively investigated.
Cells in a module don't cluster in a particular place in the brain, they're all scattered. So module isn't an anatomical description, or is it?
To some extent, they are anatomically clustered. But so, for example, you could find grid cells of the same module in the two hemispheres. They are still related, apparently. So it's complicated. It's anatomical to a point, but then it's more like functional connections. But it is true that when you record, usually you get cells of the same scale nearby, at least that's my experience and so other people's experience. And then because they are topographically organized, but the Moser laboratory showed very clearly that there is some overlap. There is some overlap among the anatomical position. So you transition from the high frequency to less frequency, but for a while you can get the same. So I got cells from three different frequencies even on the same recording side. So obviously there is an anatomical overlap, but it does tend to grow as you go more ventral, the resolution of the cell gets larger.
The other strange thing about the word module is it makes it sound discrete.
Yeah,
it is.
Like they're exactly K modules and they have like very discrete jumps between them and that's it. Is that the truth?
That's what it seems. Yeah.
It seems like that's the case. Yeah, it's been a while since I've read that.
Yeah, that was the main message when they came up with that terminology, that it seems pretty clear that it is discrete. there is only a certain numbers, because and the exact ratio from of the growth in scale, the jump in scale, seems to be constant. It seems to be a geometric progression. So it's kind of the same ratio from one module to the next, and then to the next, and then to the next. And
but they're not harmonics in each other.
No.
They must be not an integer.
It seems like the ratio is about around 1.3, 1.4. I think 1.42 was the number. It's just hard. You always have the noise in the experimental data, but
So I was just thinking that bad things that happen with harmonics.
Yes. Yeah.
What's interesting is the head direction cell signal also, at least in layer 3 of the entorhinal cortex, that also scales. It goes from very sharp tuning to more broader tuning more ventrally. But that's just in layer 3. I wasn't identified in other layers of the entorhinal cortex. So
that could be interpreted as a resolution of head direction changing as well.
Yeah, yeah. And there's at least one report on that.
Yeah, I think it was Lisa Giacomo.
Yeah.
When she was doing his work in the Moser's lab. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do these cell types work together? I mean, I've heard the grid cells spoken of as just constructors of place fields, but the grid cells might have a function that's independent of their helping to construct a place field in the hippocampus, couldn't they? Are grid cells strictly part of that? Their only job is to help make place cells.
That's a good question. they definitely contribute to place cell generation, and we've had some lengthy discussions on this topic. There's evidence showing that if you disrupt medial entorhinal cortex, at least. And you could probably get into this a little bit as well, but if you test the animals in larger environments, the place fields really, when the animal's challenged in a larger environment, the fields really fall apart. But there's some variability as well in the literature. If the animals are tested in these smaller environments, the place signal seems to be more retained. So yeah, it does seem when the animal's challenged, or at least maybe the path integrator is challenged, place cells really fall apart without an intact grid cell system. So it does seem that they do contribute to place cells.
So head direction cells also contribute to place cells in some way, right? Because the place cell's location depends on what direction the animal is going. Is that not true?
So certainly the case that if the head direction cell system is damaged, it will affect grid cells, and published some data with Jeff Taube's lab where, you lesion the anterior thalamus or inactivate it, silence it temporarily, grid cells fall apart. They lose their grid-like activity. There are more limited studies looking at hippocampal place cells and whether they're dependent on head direction cell inputs. There's one study showing that if you damage the post-subiculum, place cells, they're no longer controlled by visual stimuli in the environment. So if you rotate, a classic experiment is you rotate a visual cue in a circular environment, the place field will rotate along with it. It'll maintain its orientation relative to the cue card. But with damage to the head direction cell system, the cells remap, or they no longer basically follow that cue card. So they tend to rotate in random orientations. So it seems that at least at a minimum, the head direction cell signal is providing an orientation input for place cells. And then of course we have some data showing that if the thalamus is damaged significantly, place cells are the location specificity, their precision is lost.
And the thalamus is necessary for the head direction cells.
Yeah, definitely. So if you damage so you find head direction cells in numerous parahippocampal regions and cortical regions, and they seem to be distributed throughout the limbic system. And each area, they're slightly different. They vary in terms of their features, but we know for sure that if you damage subcortical regions like the anterior thalamus, at least in some of the areas that have been evaluated, like the post-subiculum or medial anteroidal cortex, those head direction cells in those areas are gone. They lose their directional tuning. The anterior thalamus head direction cells are highly dependent on mammillary nuclei input. So if the lateral mammillary nuclei, which provide huge inputs to the anterior thalamus, if they're damaged, that head direction cell signal is gone in the anterior thalamus. So there seems to be some processing that goes from subcortical to perihippocampal regions, cortical regions.
It seems all of this is in service of place cells. All of these structures in the brain and everything, the ultimate crown of creation.
I'm not sure about that. Because we don't, you're right. We don't exactly know all the ways that the brain can take advantage of these representation. I mean, I don't think, I'm a big proponent that grid cells can be very critical for generating place fields. But I don't necessarily think the grid cells are only there. I mean, he hinted at this fact. So, in a familiar environment or in an environment that is not too large, you can have place cells even when grid cells are disrupted. But in a novel environment that is a little larger than usual, which usually means like large enough to see a grid cell in it, then the place cells can be compromised in a novel environment. So yeah, grid cells definitely serve some, role in setting up these place fields. And to the extent that we want to think that place cells as the neural basis of the cognitive map that we were discussing before, then, they certainly play that role. But then, can they play other roles? I mean, what do they contribute to other spatial cells or other areas of the brain, and what do they reflect? So one thing we mentioned is like they might reflect path integration, because this ability of parsing space metrically, might be something that the animal can only do through some form of path integration, right? There's no sensory cues out there that can explain an hexagonal structure. And not only that, so many hexagonal structure, one per cell, each one offset a little bit, and all of them rigidly related to each other. This is something that the brain is making up. Yeah. And is making up somehow, reflecting some kind of computation. And then you're right, it only fires when the animal is there, or when Doug was here, it was like, the pattern is what you average, the experimented average. It's not a given that there is that pattern in the brain, although some models use that pattern in the brain, attractive networks. But so now the question is, what is it revealing in terms of what the brain is doing and what it is useful for? And, lots of these are still open questions. Very contentious, lively, fascinating questions.
So the connection between all of these cells firing patterns in space and path integration is usually just mentioned as a sort of course. Of course, this is the mechanism of path integration, but I don't really get how path integration can be a necessary consequence of place cells. I could imagine having a place cell and not being able to do path integration. What is the logic that leads directly to path integration from the system as we know it?
Well, that one of the ideas is that the animal, in a visually impoverished environment, they're required to get back to a starting location if they want to go there, or if they're carrying some food item back to a home nest, they have to draw upon, sense of direction to orient themselves in the right way, but also have some sort of sense of distance as well. And question is, are these signals providing that information? Are they providing that input? That hasn't really been tested systematically. I mean, there's very few experiments that have looked at that. I can think of a couple, a few with head direction cells, and maybe some with grid cells. But yeah, there's very few that have looked at this.
It seems like if you could remember a sequence of place cells going off in a sequence, you could construct a path from that principle. Do we know of any part of the brain that remembers sequences of place cell activations? What's the evidence for that?
Well, I mean, so there is all the line of research about the, for example, the replay of the sequences of place cells, the way, in the same order that they experienced during behavior, that then get replayed, for example, offline during sleep state or resting state, in which the hippocampus really, obviously it's working a very different way. The logarithmic of potential patterns are different.
This is during that sharp
wave ripples, as opposed to theta, which is in the rat, in rodents is the prominent logarithmic of potential pattern during the navigation. So, the what you were saying before is like, okay, the place of fire is when the animal is there, right? And so that's during theta, right? And but in during sleep, then you can recapitulate all the path, and now the animal is not there. So it's the places now is not pointing, is not representing where the animal is. It's recapitulating an experience that is.
It's a lot more closely related to the cognitive map that I was thinking about in the first place, because you don't have to be there. Do we know anything about
those things happening in
the hippocampus when we see them in shark wave ripples? When animals are at decision points, that sometimes happens. And also in sleep. And so some place in there must have remembered a sequence of place cells and can play it back or could maybe answer queries about it, like what place cell was between these two, mm-hmm. or something. It becomes really like a map. So do we know who remembers the sequences and where those are stored or anything like that?
I don't know that literature very well.
There is evidence, for example, from, Pfeiffer and David Foster's lab, showed that, in other labs too, that in moments in which the animal is about to do something, it seems like the sequences that are replayed tend to be the ones that then the animal executes. So there's it's not just recollecting, it's also planning to some extent. It might be used as planning. Now, there's a lot of literature pointing to CA3 as possibly the area, which is the area in the presynaptic loop of the hippocampus that most rich in intrinsic connectivity. So there is this recurrent collaterals and recurrent connectivity, and so it seems and some studies show that it seems like, for example, sharp waves and ripples that tend to originate there. So perhaps that structure is where to some extent these sequences are stored and retrieved at the right time. But I don't know that we know for sure. That seems to be like one idea there. Yeah.
This is completely satisfies my requirements for a real cognitive map, actually.
Yes.
If you imagine these maps that were drawn in that 15th century of barely explored places by early mariners, there are parts of it that are really accurate that are on this short scale where they've been. And you can know the reason they knew that coastline is because they'd been to that place and then to that one and then that one and then that one, and it was a sequence of things they experienced. And the reason they got these large scale things off is because they couldn't construct sequences of locations accurately enough to do that. Right? So
you need a map to make a map. That's why making a map is what is called a chicken and egg problem, is a circular problem, because it's hard to make a map without knowing where you are. But in order to know where you are, you usually use a map. So that's why they're distorted. They may be locally accurate, but they're globally distorted. So that, this is a problem that, you know, was facing all the roboticists who would make the first mobile robots, that now they can make maps in your, you know, most modern version of Roomba. And yeah, so it's a circular problem. It needs to be addressed with recursive Bayesian equations. At least that's how they solved it. That's one way they solved it.
Great. Well, I think that's, recursion is the solution to everything. So once we get there, we're done. So thanks a lot. That was fun for me. I don't know.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Dan and Francesco.
Yeah.
This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.